Welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast, hosted by DSI. I'm Giles Sutton, and today we have the legendary David Lee and Marina Bourdonnais, partners of Fame Architects. David and Marina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, good to be here.
Awesome. Well, as we like to always kick off our podcast, we'd love to hear a little bit about how you got started in this business.
In the business. You want to go first?
No.
How much time do we have? So
that's the podcast done.
It's yeah, I know. It'll be just that. I'll say for myself that, I went straight from high school to college and studied architecture right out of the gate. And I was one of the lucky people who kind of found their calling that early on. I didn't initially want to do architecture. I was interested in other design fields. But, you know, went to USC for an architecture summer camp when I was in high school. Instantly fell in love with it, and that kind of hooked me. And so from that late night on where we're having pizza in the studio to now, that's been my entire life as architecture. So that actually, that's kind of what got me into it. And it's continually been a profession of challenges and joys. So it's kept me hooked over the last decades.
Yeah, same for me. I started right after high school. I wanted to be an artist, you know, when I was in high school, and my parents were like, well, you know, it might be a little tough of a career. And I grew up basically around my dad always remodeling the house, and he even added a second story. So I was always surrounded by his vision and what the house would become. So I think that, you know, indirectly led me into architecture.
Yeah. And how did the firm get started?
I think for myself, I think I've always known that I would have my own practice at some point. And but I was very curious early on in my career to experience other offices and do many different types of projects. I think out of curiosity, but also knowing that having that diversity of experience would maybe be useful. And it was just a matter of kind of gaining that experience. And then at some point, it just felt right. It felt like, okay, I've done enough different things. I know enough now. I can start my own practice and do what have a bit more creative control over what we want to do. And then we did that. Of course, having your own business is like completely different from like working at an office, yeah. Which we learned. But yeah, I mean, that was, I think I've always known for probably early on.
Yeah, I mean, I also think, you know, like I always had a kind of an entrepreneurial spirit, like always wanting to start things and being very independent. So being an employee for the rest of my life, working, you know, for someone else was not really my dream. And I think we each, you know, kind of before starting our office, ended up working at the offices that we wish we would be working at. So we kind of like, you know, closed the circle and figured like it's time to, you know, give it a shot. So we did.
We're very design focused as an office and as people. So I think at some point it becomes difficult to really feel satisfied in that creative way unless you have a lot more control and you get to work with the clients much more closely to figure out specific solutions for them. And that's a really rewarding thing, which you know, we've been able to do because we have our own practice.
That's awesome. How have your global experiences and exposure to architecture, you know, around the world? I know, Marina, you come from France,
yeah.
And you've worked on projects you know, around the world as well. How has that sort of shaped your design philosophy when working on projects in LA?
I think it makes us always question, like, is the design that we're proposing authentic to, you know, the place and the people we're designing for? You know, as much as we love all the styles of architecture, we focus in modern, but modern has like a wide range of flavors, let's say. So we always try to be very honest in what we're proposing. I think the different cultural backgrounds, but also different types of projects we've worked on before allows us to always question those things and not take anything for granted.
Yeah, I echo the same sentiment. I think it's, we call it design dexterity when we're talking to clients. That's like the marketing term. And I think it's true. It's having the dexterity to have worked on different things just allows us to be more flexible in our thinking and question and push boundaries and also to know what is possible. Because there are certain methods of practicing and techniques and whatever else that exists very commonly in commercial work, or different project types like towers versus campus plans versus healthcare facilities or restaurants that don't necessarily happen commonly in residential work and vice versa. So I think that experience allows us to kind of pull at the positives of each of those and then weave them together for design reasons, for process reasons, for like everything else. And I also think that, you know, some of the projects we did in our past lives were quite large, and the budgets were very big, and there's a lot at stake. Like, you know, there's just the construction is mental of a tower. It's a completely different thing. And there's a certain level of intensity to that kind of work and detailedness. And we take that and we apply that to when we do houses. So even though it's just a house, that mentality and approach really helps things go a lot more smoothly. And it also makes us really fearless, you know, to tackle complex things. Like, that's actually what we're good at, is solving new problems. And I think that background just helps us be in that mode of problem solving and creative, and not let it become too stressful for us or for the client.
Do you think that, you know, you say fearless, I'm thinking of the architecture in LA, and you know, also just reflecting, coming from London, for example, where you really can't do much with the external, the outside. It's you know, locked down. Do you think there's a lot of creative, do you think there's a lot of freedom in the architecture in LA? A lot what allows you to really exercise, you know, as an architect, so it really kind of matches your philosophy in many ways. It matches your firm's approach.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think clients in LA are more adventurous than clients in other places, because LA is where people come to realize their dreams, you know, so they want to try something new. They want to make something, you know, for themselves. So yeah, it totally aligns with us.
Yeah, we lived in New York City for a period of time. So we have a fair amount of experience on the East Coast. And New York and LA have a lot of commonalities, but they're also very, very different. And even LA to San Francisco, the Bay Area is another region. Very, very different places, especially when we think about the clientele and the general, generally how they think about architecture. And LA is very much the, you know, it's the kind of the dreamland. It's the Wild West. And there is that kind of essence here that makes it really exciting, because everyone is, for the most part, trying to do something and trying to find their own path and voice. Whereas in other places, to be honest, like New York or San Francisco, they're a bit more conservative in a way with their approach. It's a bit more old money, I could say, as well, which tracks and makes sense. But for any creative person who wants to operate and kind of push boundaries, then yeah, that's a great observation. I think it's true.
And you both co-host a podcast. You've been hosting it for many years. We're fans here, The Second Studio. You've interviewed so many people, so many industry leaders, amazing insights and conversations. I'd love to hear what you've learned from that process. Obviously, you're managing to divide the time between, you know, running your busy practice and hosting the podcast as well. How has this been? How's it been to have that podcast going?
It was my idea to start the show, so I'm kind of responsible for all the pain it's caused. It's been wonderful. You know, we were talking before we started recording that one of the great benefits of a podcast is it's a great excuse to sit down and have clean, like, dedicated space, no interruptions, and just have a conversation for an hour and a half, or 2 hours, or whatever it is. And that's actually become a very almost rare thing these days. And having that kind of focus is just pleasant. And I think for us, you know, we're so busy in the work all the time that almost forcing ourselves to get out of that headspace for an hour and a half once a week, which in reality is not too long of a time, but to do that, to converse with other professionals or talk to whoever else, is I think really beneficial for the practice, how we think, and even just mental health to a degree, you know, because these days everyone's so busy as we are, and it's easy to just be stuck in that tunnel vision 24/7.
Yeah, and I think as a business owner too, you know, it's very reassuring in a way to talk to people who are maybe just started or have been working, you know, in the field for like 50 years and kind of see like how did they get things rolling. And, the conclusion is that there is no secret. There's no secret to it. Like, you just kind of, you have to keep putting the work and the time into it and just keep doing it and doing it. And eventually, like, it grows. So it's been interesting. A lot of the stories, too, it seems like eventually, you know, their career kind of goes back to where their initial interest started when they were younger, which also makes me wonder, like, well, where are we going to end up with our career, you know? So it's been fantastic.
Really. There's been a lot of community building. And I think, like, to Marina's point, hearing that other people have experienced the same thing is always useful from professional to professional.
Yeah.
It's also from a learning standpoint, because our audience is a lot of architects and designers, but also, let's say, clients or the general public who are just interested in architecture and design. And so on the learning side, it's one of the things we've had to do over the years is become better at speaking to both audiences at the same time, mm-hmm. which is not so easy because it's very easy within our profession to use certain words and jargon and have professional talk, which no one else understands.
It's like a different language.
It's a different language, right? And so we have to kind of balance that threshold because we do have that wide audience. And that's been a great way to honestly kind of woodshed and practice what it means to speak like that to people, especially in the early days of the podcast. A quick anecdote is actually the podcast was originally named The Midnight Charrette. It's completely different. And charrette is a common word in architecture, and it means basically when you have a fast-paced project or deadline, and that is a charrette or you're in charrette. And we just thought, like, everyone knows this word. This is a fantastic name for a podcast, The Midnight Charrette. And then after we started it, we're like, oh, no one knows this word outside of architects. And I got tired of having to explain it to people. So then eventually we said, okay, we should rebrand and retitle it to something that is more accessible.
Well, communication is clearly something you guys have had a lot of experience with, not just with the podcast. You also, I think you've also lectured at university level and frequently speak at conferences. You know, how do you find engaging with students as well and peers, you know, in those sort of educational settings? How does that sort of influence your design thinking in many ways and how you work with clients? And also, I mean, just a sort of another question, really, are you still seeing a growing interest in the younger generation in architecture and design as well?
Education, that's his
role. I'm on that side because I taught architecture off and on for about 6 years. So to answer the last question, yes, there is a strong interest in the younger generation to study architecture. What's been very different, and it's fascinating and really joyful to see, is that the students come into undergraduate school, let's say, and they come into it already interested in the big problems that we all face as a larger society. So social inequity, economic inequity, climate crisis, all these things which were on the periphery, you know, decades ago, and then became taught to students, they're now students coming to the table and saying, these are the problems, how can we help, and I'm interested in architecture. And architecture can't solve everything, but it has a significant role in a lot of ways for all of those things. And so it's been, when I go to reviews and stuff now, which is the most that I do really these days, I'm just thrilled to see that there is this generation who is ultra dedicated to it, and it's not a superficial, you know, checklist criteria they have to complete because the teacher's requiring it. They're requiring the teachers to help them to actually solve some of these problems or try and address them. And that's been the biggest shift I've seen, for sure.
I think also, like, you know, again, from, you know, practitioners, it's always refreshing to go step back into a school setting and see what's in, you know, the student's mind, because they're very much into, like, the meaning of what they're creating and not just, like, let's get through permitting and then, you know, get to CA and, like, all of the, yeah, you know, kind of, like, boilerplate things we have to do to make it happen. And it just, you know, just reminds you that this is as important as getting your permit is, why are you doing the work as you're doing and who are you doing it for?
Inspirational.
Yeah, it is.
Deeply values-based, I think, in the younger generation, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And I think there's always been this debate within the profession of architecture of how does the academic realm meet the professional realm? And there's a gap between those two. And the thought is like, well, a lot of schools these days are just doing academic exercises. It's too conceptual. It's not grounded in reality. And I think there are some institutions and some programs where that's true. And maybe if we're trying to produce, you know, very practical architects, they've gone too far to one side of the spectrum. But at the same time, to Marie's point, you need those two things to be counterpoints to each other. Mm. That's the whole purpose of them too. As soon as they become too much aligned, that synergy disappears. And that would be a horrible thing, especially for a profession like architecture, which is a creative one, and we're meant to be pushing boundaries and helping us all evolve toward better ways of building. And so school is the, you know, the petri dish for that, and it needs to be maintained in a way. But whenever we speak to students, or at professional conferences and things, it's I'm always amazed by how different the audiences are, which maybe sounds obvious, but like talking to students versus talking to professional colleagues versus talking to clients, those are like completely different people. And I say that also because of the podcast. It's like sometimes we put out content and we have, and maybe the content is more directed toward one of those three audiences. And then two of the three are like, why are you saying that? I'm like, because, you know, there's two-thirds, there's everyone else in the world who's not an architect who needs to understand what we're doing. And I think that communication thread you were describing, that's also been interesting when we engage, because we are actively engaged in all three, you know, sectors. Mm. And it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to do sometimes.
No, for sure. And I'm just, as you were speaking just then, I was thinking that, you know, as it relates to, you know, what's happened in the Palisades and obviously the Eaton fires, the devastation that we've seen there, another sort of communication has to come into that with clients that have potentially lost their homes and sort of, you know, comforting them through mm-hmm. that process. How did you, what was your sort of personal reaction to what happened in the Palisades, and how did that kind of motivate your famed response to it?
I think we're not from LA, you know, but we were like very devastated seeing in the news and just witnessing, you know, a whole neighborhood like being gone. It felt really unreal. And as architect, I think every architect in LA felt, you know, kind of like stabbed in the heart that, you know, those homes are not there anymore, and that it's part of our responsibility to help bring them back in a way, again, that is meaningful and responsive to the people who lost their home. So,
I'm from Orange County, so it was shocking and it was surreal. It would mm-hmm. be another word, right? It's hard to fathom. And then when we visited the Palisades for the first time, it was emotional. I mean, it was emotional. It was also purely from our architectural standpoint, very bizarre to see so far. Like the sense of scale is completely lost, right? Because the lots, for example, the Alphabet Street seems so small without houses and streets and trees and whatever else. And so it completely distorts your sense of reality. I think the value of the home, though, like Marina was saying, the other interesting thing is because this is our job and we believe in it, that we, maybe more so than the average person, believe in the value and the importance of having a home that feels a certain way for somebody and what it does for them in their lives. And architecture and design, for the most part, is a fairly passive thing. It's not like other forms of media or things that you're engaged with actively, right? It's just around you, and you might not consciously think about it all the time. But it does have a significant impact on how you feel and certainly how you function. We talk about the utility of a house. And so these are things that we know because we're in it, but I don't think for the average person they feel that so viscerally or at the surface like we do. And I think once the fires happened and people lost 30 years of their belongings and the house, I think it was triggering. They realized, like, this is, like, who am I without my residence? My whole routine is gone. All my clothes are gone. My driving routine, like, I'm used to taking this left and that right. I don't do that anymore. Now I'm doing a different path to get to this, you know, apartment or this condo or this house that I'm renting. And so that has been... I don't know what the word is. I guess interesting to hear from clients when they describe their former house, which a lot of those houses were not custom. Right? They bought it, moved in, right? It's not a custom house yet. They had that strong attachment and emotion. Hearing it directly from them in their own words, how we would think of it, has been kind of enlightening.
And I think the thing that we, you know, so what we're thinking about is that it's not just a house, you know, that disappeared in the middle of a street. It's like the whole street, yeah. Like the trees, the neighbors across the street, the neighbors to your sides, like everything is gone. So I think, again, like in terms of the city and rebuilding the neighborhood, it's about thinking about how to rebuild a neighborhood and not just one house at a time. Like the Palisades and even Altadena were very special places, right? How could you rebuild from scratch a neighborhood and make it special again? I think that's probably one of the bigger question that we should all, you know, think about as we move forward with this.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, David, as well, I completely agree. You know, a lot of the homeowners there, they hadn't sort of banked on having to sort of face a construction project. Their entire lives bought homes that, you know, were historic homes and done sort of light remodels or something like that, but actually, you know, are now faced with the prospect of having to have a, you know, go through a rebuild project. So there is a lot of, you know, treading carefully with the homeowners there to be sensitive to their needs. But so we should really talk a little bit about Case Study 2.0, which I know FAME's been very actively involved in. For those who haven't heard about the Case Study 2.0 initiative, can you tell us a little bit about the organization and what your involvement looks like in that?
Yeah, so Case Study 2.0 is a program founded by Crest Real Estate, who I know you guys have had on the show. And for those who are familiar with Los Angeles, you know that there was an original Case Study program in the 1940s and 60s, which enlisted a bunch of architects to design new houses that were meant to be affordable, kind of push the boundaries of construction and question and think about what life should be like at that time. And I think over the many decades, there's been a lot of discussions about this idea of another Case Study program, and then Crest took on the initiative to start it, and it after the fires, which felt appropriate. So this program, it has a lot of parallels with the first one in that it enlisted a number of architects to each create a house of their own that would prioritize several things. One is fire resiliency, obviously, in the wake of rebuilding. So the purpose of the program is to help rebuild after the fires. So fire resiliency also hit a more accessible construction cost for people needing to rebuild. And then on our side as an office, we also kind of took it one step further and thought, okay, let's question a few things about construction. Let's also really think about what does it mean to live now in this decade or the 21st century that's different from back then. And what are we seeing in homeowners and people as I don't like the word trends, but as modes of living that should be adopted into the house? And what is the Palisades, the history of the Palisades? How does that fit into the narrative of the house that we're designing? That's the broader Case Study program. And in essence, it's a catalog of houses that folks have designed that are, again, meant to be more cost effective.
You know, in to your point where, you know, homeowners did not elect to do a new construction, where do you start, right? Where do you start where everything's gone and you've never done that? So the Case Study is to kind of provide them with, again, a catalog of choices and kind of like the first few steps to get going. And I think what's a little bit different from a typical project is that you already know what the design is going to look like, where a typical process when we get hired by, you know, custom home clients on the daily basis is we design as we go. So the client doesn't know at the beginning what the house is going to look like. So this was a very interesting exercise in some ways, like designing without a specific client, still trying to appeal to, you know, more people than just one, not everybody. Like we know that, you know, it's not for everybody, but kind of putting that aside and see how could we design a house that would make sense to a lot of people.
Yeah. The other important thing I'll mention is that the Case Study program, Case Study 2.0 program, is solving a lot of problems, but in a very specific niche, in my view. So we all know in LA that there are custom houses which cost easily $1,200 a square foot and up, and that's one tier. And to be honest, finding the right people for that tier of work is relatively easy because there's a lot of people practicing there. And then you have folks at the complete opposite end, the lower end, which are doing stuff for whatever cost amount per square foot. And there's a big middle ground. And this is like a larger trend we're seeing in society, right? That middle is gone. And so what do people do when they want something nice, but they don't have, or they don't want to spend $1,200 a square foot for construction cost alone? And they know if they go the $300 a square foot, that is crazy and unrealistic, and they're going to be unhappy, and all kinds of problems will take place because it's not really quality stuff. And so the program is answering that question of how do we do something that's in the middle, and that's actually not easy to do. I'd also say that the houses, because of that, they are, I would describe at least our house as being a custom house in the quality of construction and design, of course, in our view, biased, but it is pre-designed. So what's been interesting is that people hear of pre-designed houses, and the only reference point people have in recent years are like you know, quickplans.com right. or prefab, yeah. the really cheap stuff that all custom builders and professionals like shiver when they hear, because it's not even close to being the same thing. And so some folks are like, well, this is still expensive because it's for a pre-designed house. And the point is that this is pre-designed, so it's actually somewhere between the two, right? It's of a certain quality, but it is pre-designed, and I think there is a real need for that. And that's, I think, what the larger program is trying to address.
And, you know, for those that are listening or watching, you know, your project is absolutely beautiful. I'd love to ask you a few more questions about how you approach that. It's a little bit difficult for those that are listening without having actually a graphical representation of it, but you can see the project on the Case Study 2.0 website and also on your website as well, yeah. Fame Architects website. Can you speak a little bit to how you? I know you mentioned Marina just now. It was challenging to approach a build without actually having a client to sort of yes no decisions that you were making, but also in terms of where it's actually physically located. You know, in the fire zone. How did that approach? You know, how you came to design it.
Well, I think we. The different years of experience and you know working with clients kind of like David was mentioning led us to a few things that in a way made sense for us to implement in the design, but it also seemed like it resonated with a lot of clients. So we implemented a lot of the indoor outdoor living, the need for privacy and security from the street, but still feeling connected, the flexibility of the plans. A lot of clients they're thinking of different phases, age, in life, and maybe like in-laws moving in or having an au pair. So having a plan that could accommodate those things, those were things that I don't think were really out of the ordinary. And in a way, it was easier not to have a client because we could move on those design phases a little bit quicker, right?
Yeah.
Which was very interesting.
Yeah, the project happened super, super quickly. I think it's been interesting the last 10 or 15 years. One of the big issues that's come up with clients repeatedly is privacy and security mm-hmm. if we go further. And you guys know this as mm-hmm. well, the space that you're in. And it's more and more the case, right? And to the point to where folks who have a lot of money are building safe houses or safe bunkers, right? So that's one thing that is real. The other is that the essence of the Palisades as a community and a neighborhood was an openness to the street. The engagement of the sidewalk, engaging in discourse and conversation, or just casual waving to your neighbor, that was the Palisades. Trees down the street, kids, grandparents, that kind of vibrant community. And so, in other projects we've done, privacy is prioritized to a much higher degree, which is fine. But if we're rebuilding the Palisades, then we have to think beyond just that. So conceptually for us, the problem was how do we balance these what would appear to be two opposing ideas of privacy and security on one side and the other side, openness and engagement. And so that actually led us to eventually title the house the Shift House because it has certain features that allow the user and the family to mediate and control the amount of privacy and openness to the street and to other things. And that was, I think, one of the key essence of the project and how we approached it. And then, the program, we had a good sense of what, could fit on a 5,200 square foot and 6,500 square foot lot. And we know what should go in there. We also conversed with some real estate agent friends who know the area very well and said, hey, can you check this for us and take a look at the plan, take a look at a program? Is there something we're missing, just to make sure? And so we felt very confident going into it. And we can always adapt the plan as well.
And I think, by talking to homeowners who lost their homes in the Palisades, a lot of the thing that they're seeking with the design of their new homes is the feeling of peace and kind of like safety in a more, let's say, spiritual way. Mm. So that's really something that we try to really think about when we design every spaces of the project was like, how would you feel if you were in that space? Would you feel like, you're cocooned and protected? Would you feel like you're in the city and in the hustle and bustle? So that was really key.
Yeah, the emotion of the project, I think, was a big one. And even mm-hmm. getting to the palette and the materials, we debated a lot internally of what do we want this to be? Because oftentimes the clients are the source of inspiration for that. And we intentionally created a house or a palette rather that was more bright and uplifting and joyful. And even the renderings kind of convey this. rather than a kind of a dark and moody, or like I know the burnt wood is very popular and I love it. But it also, in the narrative, we were questioning internally, does this make sense as a fire rebuild to have a house that is of a kind of darkened color? Which actually, we have an option of that, and it looks great. But so for the renderings, at least, we decided, let's do something that's more uplifting. And if people want to go that darkened steel color, we can certainly do that. And we have, again, we've done tests, and it looks great. But from a choosing one palette, because we can only choose one, right? That was the kind of vibe we wanted to create.
And you see that it's very light and yeah, joyful. I can see that in the design. It's beautiful. And it makes me think what the role of architecture in terms of healing and the community and, you know, reweaving the community. How do you see that playing out with the fact that, you know, with the devastation that's there right now, are you seeing clients sort of a willingness to jump straight in, or is there some intrepidation there, do you think?
I think people are taking their time in a way that, you know, they don't really have much control over it because of conversation with insurance. But I think they're also, because they're very attached to their neighborhood, they want to make sure that they're making the right decisions. So we've seen people moving very carefully just to make sure that they don't rush into deciding something that they're going to regret 2 weeks later and, you know, have to backtrack. Like, that's not how things should go. The interesting thing is that, you know, we often tell them, like, you know, it's really rare that you can rebuild a whole neighborhood at the same, like, at once, right? And a lot of them are in good conversation with their neighbors if they haven't sold their lots yet. And, you know, that's something we encourage, is like seeing what is your neighbor going to build and to kind of share with them what you're planning to build. So we can make sure that, you know, their bathroom window doesn't align with your bedroom window, or like, how could we design, you know, the fence between the two properties?
That's a really
interesting point. Like you never get the chance to to talk to your neighbor about, like, what are we going to build? And I think that goes back to rebuilding the community, and also, you know, like the front yard. Like, what are you doing with your front yard? Well, I'm thinking of doing that. You know, we have clients who have a kind of a shared front yard with their neighbor, and they're each wanting to rethink about it in a way that's different from what was there before. So it's gonna engage in conversation amongst just homeowners and architects of the different homeowners will probably, you know, have this conversation, which, you know, is what we're born for as professionals. Yeah. So this is going to be amazing.
I also think that the profession has had architects have had a history of focusing only on their building, which makes sense when now that I've said that, but like they only focus on in their site. So once we, as a typical architect, once we know the setbacks and all that stuff, we do our thing and that's it, right? And I don't care about whatever else is happening in the street. And our actual background is quite diverse, as we talked about, and part of that in that mix is in actually urban design and urban planning, urban thinking. So community building is another way to phrase it. And first of all, I don't think any architecture should actually be thought about in the way I just described before. You have to think about the larger context, whether it be the neighbors, whether it's just the neighbors, it's also the neighborhood, it's the city, it's the region, it's the cultural context. Like, we've done work on the, you know, in the East, it's very different over there. And all things have to be considered, even if you're doing one house. So I like to think about every piece of architecture as being one building block of a larger design, in a way. And this is actually, like you said, the first time an opportunity to have much closer collaboration between the neighbor to neighbor in a certain way. And
you know, there's some neighbors who want to develop their lot as much as they can because they have the chance to do that. There is some that just want a smaller house, like keep it small and, you know, and cozy. So it's very interesting. And then, you know, throw in developers who are buying the lots and are going to do whatever they want. So it's very interesting. It's kind of a case study overall, you know, project for the neighborhood in itself, right? Seeing like how things are going to unfold.
And there should definitely be diversity. And that was a marker of the Palisades as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some folks have asked us, like, well, if I hire you guys and purchase the shift house, like, what happens if, you know, I have five of these on my street? And I said, well, first of all, the chances of that are probably not very high. But beyond that, we're not allowing that. The whole point is to offer a solution, but we're not trying to build, you know, 100 of these in a row. And if for some reason there happen to be five people in a row who want to build the same house, we would have serious reservations about it. all of those homeowners would have to talk to each other. And ideally, in my mind, we would use the core essence of the project, which is the floor plan and the space planning and the fluidity of space, but then wrap it completely differently so that from the outside and even the inside, you don't actually know it's the same house. And from a design standpoint as an architect, that's a very, very interesting set of problems to solve.
And I think that's also why, you know, the 40 architects who are participating in the case study program were interested in the program, was to provide that variety of design to homeowners and make sure that, you know, the Sears catalog would not show up again and rebuild all the alphabet streets the same way.
That's not the point.
I guess we have the original case study as well to the original case study to sort of draw upon in a way. It's funny you should say that, David, about the houses. I was actually just thinking that as you were saying it, that the chance of a whole street of the same fame street.
It's just very unlikely to happen.
And in the same time, if you tell me like there is a whole street of Eames House, I would be like, I want to go there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that would be interesting, right? Discounts for everybody.
I have to ask, you know, in terms of, you know, lighting technology, other technologies that are going into your homes, I'm curious, you know, how do those also sort of play into this, you know, trying to build a character to not just a home, but to a community? Do you have any kind of thoughts on the role of like maybe lighting and maybe even landscape? I know I was talking about technology, but I'm thinking about, you know, exterior lighting to project, what the homes look like from the outside, not necessarily what's on inside.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's well timed. So we have onboarded Neo Lighting Design. They're a fantastic top tier lighting designer, and they are very graciously offering their services at a significant discount to their credit, like us. They're basically matching the same kind of discount that we're doing. And so lighting, it's funny you mentioned it because I feel like it's one of the most underrated but very important aspects of any project. And so we knew that we want to use a lighting designer, which is kind of it's not common and sort of counterintuitive for the lower price point of projects that we're trying to hit. But they've graciously agreed to do it at a discount. So we have a lighting designer involved, and what they're going to do is come up with a fantastic lighting plan for the outside, the inside, and the outside of the house. And that will be baked into the base model and the pricing of it. It's in there. And if a client wanted to come in and say, okay, I'm going to upgrade to Ketra lighting, which is like the top tier lighting, and I want to have all different other kinds of, you know, features and things, then they have the option to do that through an additional services. But with this lighting designer, you know, Neil, shout out to them and Garrett, we're very confident that this house is going to feel really, really good. And that this was something that we've talked about from the very beginning to achieve that.
And I think, you know, it's interesting you ask that because if I'm thinking I'm walking my dog at night, you know, down the street in the Palisades, and I feel like the thing that makes a neighborhood feel, you know, cozy in a place where you want to walk down the street is at night the lighting of a home. And there is nothing that's more homey to me than, you know, like a few entry lights and like maybe like light up the nice plants that are, you know, in the front yard. And if you don't have that, it's just a dark street that you don't want to be in. And in a sense, it also goes back to security, the feeling of security, right? Just a few lights in somebody's front yard and repeat that, you know, 50 times across the neighborhood, like, just makes the place feel one way or the other. So I think it's
and not overdoing it, too. There's a sensitivity to light pollution that we're very mindful of. So if people are online and look at, we have a nighttime rendering of the front facade. And the front facade, real quick, so it has, you know, a garage on one side, and on the other side it has a screen gate that covers the garage as well. So the bottom level is a uniform gesture. But as I said, on one side, it's a screen gate that's operable, which I'll talk about in a second. But it means that when it's closed at night, it provides privacy, but you still get the filtering of light coming through. So there's going to be a really wonderful, and on the other side of it, there's an open space and then a full glass living room facade. So, and because of that distance, there's privacy. Because of the screen, there's privacy, but you still get the flickering of light and just like little shadows that are moving behind to activate the facade at night. And this was something that, you know, we work closely with our team to really think about how does the house feel like throughout the day and engage the street And I know the question was about technology, but you know, with that gate that's operable and moving, it means that when it's closed, it's for privacy, and it creates a private garden that faces the living room on the inside of the property. When it's open, though, that private garden connects to the front yard and creates a really big outdoor space, which connects to a living room that's indoor-outdoor on both sides, which connects to a pool. So the idea was, like, when the gate is closed, you have a really gracious indoor-outdoor living experience in the entire property throughout the house. And when it's open, it becomes a really intense space that activates the sidewalk and an area for barbecues, neighbor gatherings, and big events and birthday parties and kids to play and run around through the living room and back and forth between the front and the back and that kind of narrative. And so that was what we had envisioned when we were coming up with the plan.
Yeah, lighting design really is an art form.
That
mix of sort of, it's art and science at the same time. We love working with lighting designers for that reason, really. It really helps support the lighting control systems that we put in. Anyway, so we're running out of time now. So I just, you know, I just want to say any sort of closing thoughts, really, on the case study project and how we feel about, maybe just a view on how you feel about the Palisades and how we're going to, you know, rebound from this. Any sort of closing thoughts on that?
I'm very hopeful. I think, you know, community is a word that's been used a lot and probably comes up very often in these recordings. And it's very true. It's a very strong community. There's a resiliency to the people, absolutely. And it's the heart of that place, and that will continue to thrive because of the folks who are rebuilding. So actually a lot is really owed to the clients who are dedicated to the space, and of course the professionals who are contributing. So I'm very optimistic about it. I'm very excited. We've had a lot of phone calls about the house already, the chef house in particular, and also doing custom work in the neighborhood. So as much as we can do to give back with the case study program in forms of discounts and other things, we will continue to do. I think it's necessary and I think it's going to turn out well.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see, you know, the rebuilding. I think you have to have a lot of patience to, you know, take on such projects. But I'm very hopeful that, you know, everybody is going to do their best.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, guys. It's been a great conversation. It's been fantastic having you in. Thanks for your support.
Thank you.
We look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charles.